Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Oh yeah, that penis is inside him. What's on this side? Oh, and again.
Yeah.
Oh, lovely.
I think she's 1,200 years old. Once I said 12,000, no one batted an eyelid. I was like, thanks, kid. You got my back on this one.
Hello, dear listener. Hannah here from Banging Book Club. I am really excited to share with you this very special episode. If you've been with us for a while, you will know that in our first year, one of the books we read was called A Little Gay History. And that's exactly what it was. And it was based around a lot of objects that you can find in the British Museum. Skip forward a couple of years and I have met some amazing people who work at the British Museum doing incredible work with the objects and education around sex and sexuality and gender. And so I thought we have to turn this into a podcast episode. Just quick disclaimer, neither Banging Book Club nor myself are sponsored by the British Museum. I just think that this is a really cool program, and also I'm a history graduate and I specialized in sexual history, so this is just right up my street. So the British Museum run relationships and sex education workshops for Key Stage 3, 4 and 5 students, so that is secondary school. The workshops are completely free, they're an hour and a half, and there's a whole bunch of different themes to choose from, such as pornography, consent, body image, LGBT and gender identities. If you are a student of that age, I would highly recommend you telling your teachers about this. If you are a teacher, I would highly recommend bringing your students along to something like this. It was created by Melanie, who works at the British Museum, and Chloe, who is an artist and educator. And it was actually Chloe who showed me around and talked me through all of these objects, which is what you're about to listen to. First of all, I'll let Chloe explain a little more about how the program came about.
I was working here as an artist, and then I saw that there was a Shunga exhibition on, which is incredible, like erotic Japanese woodblock prints. Mm-hmm. And there was a sign saying, nobody under 16 can come in here. And I was like, oh, this is such a lost opportunity.
Damn.
Because actually, like, this erotic imagery often features a lot of mutual pleasure, whereas a lot of the erotic imagery that people under 16 are informally looking at, obviously not legally, but informally mm-hmm. looking at, is like, as in mainstream porn, is incredibly like not mutually pleasurable.
Yeah.
For all the people involved in it. Normally just the pleasure is reserved for those of us with penises. So I thought, this is a great opportunity to be able to talk about pornography and gender identities and consent and LGBTQ+ and body image in the museum using the objects here, because they're obviously here. Mm-hmm. It's just that, like, they're not being used for this purpose at the moment. So that's when we set up the program.
So what you're about to listen to is myself and Chloe wandering around the British Museum on a Thursday morning, talking about all these objects and the themes around sex and gender and consent and all of those things. But quick announcement beforehand, December is coming up, if you hadn't noticed. And December is listener's choice in terms of the book that we are reading. So currently we are reading Inferior by Angela Saini. And we've had a look at all of the recommendations that you've sent in over the year on social media and on Goodreads. And we've come up with a final four. And by the time you're listening to this, there will be a poll over on our Twitter at Banging Book Club. And you can vote for your favourite of what you want us to read in December. This has been a very long introduction. I hope you enjoy our sex object tour of the British Museum. I have also taken pictures of each of the objects, so I'll be putting those on social media. And if you're listening on Acast, there is a function where you'll be able to see the picture of what we're talking about during that bit. I will figure out how to make that work. So you'll be able to see the pictures of the objects whilst you're listening to us talk about it. We hope that you enjoy this special episode.
Okay, so this is the Queen of the Night, and we're in Mesopotamia right now.
Oh.
In 1750 BC, and she is kind of like a human and kind of not like a human.
Yeah, she's got like claw feet and wings, but she also has like a female body. There are some boobs there, there's like a belly button and some hips and a waistline.
Definitely. She's nude, not naked. We can't see her pubes.
Oh, I see. Yes. Is that the difference between nude and naked?
Yeah. So this is fine. This is not shameful. This is cool. She's a goddess.
Oh, okay.
Because she's got horns on her head.
Right.
Yeah, so that means that she's a Mesopotamian deity. We don't know who she is. She might be Ishtar or she might be Ereshkigal.
Oh, okay.
They're two like goddesses. One, Ishtar is the goddess of sexual love and war, and then Ereshkigal is the goddess of the underworld.
Ooh.
And her wings are pointing downwards, so that could be kind of denoting underworldness.
I really wish you guys could see what Chloe is doing right now, like her movements.
This kind of thrust, this hip thrust. And she's stood on some lions,
yeah,
some owls, and she's got a rod in each hand. All this kind of curly thing.
Yeah, is it like a whip? That's where my brain went.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, maybe. Maybe she's Ishtar, yeah. Sexual love and whipping. So she also has the power to change genders.
Oh.
Not herself, but of other people.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so she can change male to female, female to male. So we talk about this object when we're thinking about gender as a kind of fixed idea, or gender as something that's more fluid.
Yeah.
And when we talk about how different cultures reproduce their ideas of gender, either through the rigidity and the binary, or through the fluidity
and how it can change. Yeah. What kinds of things do like young people have to say about this, like when you talk about gender with her?
Often we talk about their ideas of identity and sexuality and religion.
So it's really important. Okay.
Yeah, it's really important for young people that she's a goddess who's doing this, who has this ability to change people's genders, not just
because that makes it like more official.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's someone who's seen as like the absolute authority. Like a goddess is the absolute authority. It's not like some charlatan who's come into town and said like, "Hey, you can be male. You can be transgender." It's not that. It's her saying, "I'm a goddess and I have the ability, or maybe we all have the ability to change genders." Gender is not fixed.
Do you know like why she might have changed people's genders? Was it if they requested it, if they asked, or like maybe it was a punishment? Like why did she change people's genders? Do we know that?
I don't know. Maybe we do, but I don't.
Yeah.
But that's something that we can discuss. We can talk about, if it would be a punishment to change gender for anybody in the group.
Yeah.
How that would affect their lives, if it would affect the way they dress, the way they eat, how they express themselves, the music they listen to, the friends they have.
How they're perceived.
Absolutely, definitely.
Really interesting. And there's also a picture, a smaller one, of a reconstruction of the colours that she would have had, which have obviously faded. And the owls are so cute. Look at the owls in it. She's like bright red.
Yes.
Which is really cool.
And she's got a black background, which is one of the reasons why she's called Queen of the Night.
Oh, I see.
Because that black background may denote the nighttime. And also, the British Museum didn't originally buy this object when it was kind of suggested that they should buy it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Because they thought it was a fake. They didn't think it was real. And also, I'm not sure if this is why, but she's called Queen of the Night as well because of she might be a brothel sign. There were lots of these made.
Ah.
So there's a kind of link there. So big enough on the sex workers.
Oh, so there's like lots of these.
Yes. So this is a kind of baked, straw-tempered clay kind of relief. But yeah, it's something that could be produced lots and lots of times. It's not like an individual piece that was carved out of marble. Yeah, and you can kind of see she could be like a sign, like swinging.
This way.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, lots to talk about.
So this is an object that isn't part of like the education tour that you do, but you showed it to me last time and I love it. So this is a silk wall hanging. It's like a tapestry. It's made in India by a group of women belonging to an NGO where they get to learn skills, and they're often like poor or illiterate women, so it's a way to help them earn money. And they started to use these tapestries to address issues such as like poverty and social injustice. And this one is all about AIDS. So the first time I saw this, I thought those were milk bottles.
Yes. Yeah.
But they are in fact condoms. And there's all sorts of just stuff going on.
People are holding condoms. It looks like they're passing to other people.
And there's two people lying down inside on a bed together. And then there's another person like getting a blood transfusion.
And then they're all on the edge as well. I love condoms as a decorative kind of motif. You never see that. I want to see that more.
Oh, wait, and there's like, are those pregnant women as well? The ones with like the big bumps?
Yes.
Yeah, I love it. I think it's really interesting. Just like that these would be used as, I don't know if they'd be used like as educational tools about like how AIDS is spread, or as like awareness raising.
Yeah.
But I just think this is very cool. Which gallery are we in, Chloe?
We're in Living and Dying.
Which
is, totally relevant.
Yeah.
And I think we don't touch on this so much in our education sessions, because we kind of try to stay away a little bit from sexual health as we're aware that sexual health is something that does manage to get covered in school a bit in terms of sex education. Mm-hmm.
Like, so that is kind of the bare minimum that you get.
Yeah, and then you definitely get condoms.
And then the stuff that you talk about, like with consent and pornography, probably is less likely to get covered. So.
Yes, yeah.
No, that makes sense.
But yeah.
But do check it out if you're here, because it's great. It is really cool.
We are now in the new Asia Galleries, room 33 at the British Museum, and we are in front of the magnificent Tara.
Tara!
She is shining.
She's gold, she is stunning. She is like right at the end of this gallery. Like, she's like the main event. There are currently a lot of people like taking group photos with her, which I love.
Yeah, me too. She's such a star. She's stunning. So apparently she's like solid cast bronze and she's gilded, so that's why she looks gold. So she's got a thin layer of gold on her. She's got this fantastic hairstyle. Mm-hmm. She's got this great...
bit like Marge Simpson-esque.
Yes, absolutely. And apparently it's like, she's got some like friends in there as well. If we get a little bit closer, she's got some kind of animal-y friends kind of holding up her do. Oh. And she's got these fantastically long earlobes. She's got these stretched earlobes. She has her hands. So she's kind of personifying the power of Buddha to save us, his compassion and his abilities to save. So her hands are in the kind of mudras.
Okay, like what, palms facing and like one up, one down.
Exactly, yeah. So she has the gift of giving in her right hand, I think it is. I'm going to get confused. And then in her other hand, she was holding a lotus flower, but that's gone now.
Oh, sad lotus flower.
And she's got these, wicked hips. She's got this tied cloth around her hips. And then she's got nothing on top.
No, you can see her nipples and everything. So is this naked? Or it's not, because she's got cloth covering her bottom.
Yeah, no way. Yeah, she's nude.
She's still nude.
Definitely. But so we compare her here to Apollo in the Enlightenment Gallery, who's a very kind of classical marble figure of a god. So we kind of compare like how we feel about looking at his body and how we feel about looking at Tara's body.
Okay.
And often that's within a body image session. And people are shocked by how exciting Tara is. Sexually exciting.
Well, have you seen her boobs and that waist as well? Like, it's
she's
a bit
fun.
It's a bit like Disney princess-esque when you think about like how tiny they make their waists. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, that isn't humanly possible.
No.
But is she a goddess?
So she was a Hindu mother goddess. And she was then kind of transformed into a Buddhist, having a Buddhist role, so like personifying the Buddha's power to save and his compassion. And she's from Sri Lanka, so medieval Sri Lanka. So she's 1,200 years old.
Damn.
And she was either gifted or somehow removed from the last king of Kandy when it was annexed during the early 19th century by the British.
Right.
She ended up here at the British Museum in the 1830s and was immediately locked away.
Oh, so no one could see her.
Oh my God, yeah, they were like, no way, she is way too erotic, she is dangerous.
So when was she brought out to be like the star of the show?
About 30 years later, I believe, she was allowed to be put out for everyone to see. Even though it was absolutely known that she is not pornographic, as in she was not made to arouse us sexually.
Okay.
It was always known that she's absolutely a figure to, not to worship, but to be the center of meditation. And yet still.
Is that how we define pornography? That it's in the intention of why it's made? It's like, if this is made to arouse people, mm-hmm. then it is porn. So what if you're making something that isn't naked, isn't sexual, but its intention is to arouse someone with, say, a particular fetish, then is it porn?
Yeah, in my mind, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Interesting. So do you talk about porn with her? Or like...
Not so much, no.
Because she's not porn.
Yeah, she's not porn. And it feels maybe a little bit too easy to... I guess the link with porn would be the link with a certain kind of idealised body type.
Yeah.
So that's why we normally talk around body image, like when we're looking at her. But we do bring out pictures of Kim Kardashian because we talk about kind of unrealistic body types and thinking about maybe if your body is your own, what's wrong with plastic surgery? Like thinking about living in a body and having a body for people to look at. So trying to think about those two different kind of viewpoints on your body. Like, is your body to be looked at or is it to be lived in? So we're now in room 25, Africa. It's a group of rooms, to be fair, and which is representative of the many countries that make up the continent of Africa. And we are in front of the Benin bronzes.
Yeah.
So these are cast plaques in relief. So they've got a flat back, but then the bodies of the people on the front are sticking out.
Yeah, and there's loads of them, and they're all different.
Yes, yeah, lots of them feature the king with soldiers, other members of the royal family as well.
Some of them just have like swords and like weapons on them.
Yeah, sure.
So what do you talk about with these in terms of the education with young people?
Sure, so we bring, this is often our introductory object when we're talking about consent, so it's during the consent workshop. And that's because I find that it's really helpful to start thinking about whether we live in a consensual society, kind of.
In general.
In general, yeah. Exactly.
Like, not even sexual, but everything.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So we think about how these objects came to the British Museum and if they're here consensually or not. Mm-hmm. So these objects were taken from the palace in the Kingdom of Benin in 1897 by British troops during a punitive mission. I think punitive means punish, does it?
Sounds like it, yeah. Okay. It seems like where that word comes from.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you. In a kind of retaliatory act against the Kingdom of Benin after they killed some British people. And that kind of, that was because of trade and who was in control of the trade coming in and out of Benin.
Right. And this is in Nigeria.
Yeah, southern Nigeria. So lots and lots of plaques. I was reading online and it said up to 4,000 ivory and brass.
Wow.
Not bronze, brass, I think. Yeah, plaques were taken from the kingdom when the palace was destroyed and the king was captured. And those were distributed, bought, auctioned off to museums and I guess private collectors as well throughout Europe. So there's loads and loads in Berlin. There's quite a few as you can see here as well. And from the 1960s, the Nigerian government have been asking for these objects back, for them to be repatriated. And we know that, that's an issue that is mirrored in other museums around the world as well at the moment. So that's where we begin our discussions around consent. If these are here consensually, if they're not, if museums are consensual spaces, we think about the rules of the British Museum. They are somewhere on the wall. So it's like there's a rule, there's rules that we're all consenting to.
Oh, I see.
As soon as we come in here, which is like not to eat food in here.
Yeah, no flash photography.
All that kind of stuff. Yeah. But often we're actually not necessarily consenting specifically to that, but we are consenting by being in here. So we kind of talk about that as well. We talk about...
Is it like informed consent or not?
Yes, exactly. So we talk about those things, about verbal and non-verbal signs of consent. So then we kind of, come into our relationships. So we think about maybe in our friendships, do we always practice consent or do we sometimes practice coercion? So do people always want to come to the cinema with you? Do they always want to come shopping with you?
Or are you like guilt tripping them?
Exactly.
Like, yeah.
Exactly.
And, it may seem harmless, but yeah. And I think one of the things that I've been thinking a lot about recently in terms of consent and how, like, do we or do we not live in a consensual culture and society is how terrible we are at saying no to non-sexual things. Mm-hmm. So, like, if I was like, oh, Chloe, do you want to go get a coffee next week? And you're like, I really cannot be bothered.
Yeah, I do not drink coffee.
But you don't, but you will not say no to me because you don't say no when someone's asked you for a coffee. You're like, sorry, I'm busy. Or you might just go anyway. Mm. Or you lie about like why you can't go.
Yeah.
But we'll never say, no, I don't want to. Like, and I find it really interesting that like, if we aren't taught to be able to say, no, I don't want to do that for a coffee invite, how are we expected to say, no, I don't want that when it comes to like a sexual act? Like,
oh
how? So that really is something that I've been thinking about a lot.
Definitely. And even like, how can I say no and still continue this relationship with this person?
Right. Yeah.
Or how can I say no and because I don't want to continue it? Like, how then do you carry on? Because aren't you supposed to say yes and want to hang out all the time with each other?
No, this is great. And then from this, do you then continue talking about consent with other objects as well?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So we think about what the difference between people and objects are, because obviously there is a difference.
Oh,
but actually, often when people are thinking about their sexual autonomy, there can be a kind of like, who do I belong to when I'm in a relationship? We're so used to saying, you're mine and I'm yours.
Mm.
And actually, is that helpful? Is that a healthy kind of thing to strive to be someone else's? So we'll go up to see Tara, who we just saw a moment ago, and think about consent with her, seeing as me and my line manager, Melanie, who's not here today, but she's great. She really made the programme happen.
Yeah, we love Melanie.
Whoop, whoop. Yeah, we saw a visitor come up and tweak Tara's nipple, which was absolutely non-consensual. So then we'll talk about, like, maybe Tara's really into nipple tweaking, and that can be her decision, and she can come out and say that. So we'll think about yes, no, maybe lists that you can get off of Scarlatine website.
Yes, yes, no, maybe lists. And also the fact that Tara is an actual object, like, here, in the sense of how we're interacting with Tara. She is an object, but what about Tara, the person, the goddess, that this object is based off? And so, like, that dichotomy, I guess.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Yeah, it's exciting. So Hannah, now we're in the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
Hooray. And we're standing in front of two busts of some guys. One of them.
Pretty well-known guys.
Yeah, right, I know. Mm-hmm. One of them is an emperor. Pretty important one.
Pretty important guy, yeah. Hadrian.
Hadrian,
yeah. That one.
Who made the wall.
Oh, yeah.
Also the Pantheon.
Damn.
Thank you. I think he was emperor for like 21 years or something. He was a very successful Roman emperor. He apparently was like really good at leading and didn't start too many wars, didn't start too many other fights with other people.
Aww,
so it was a period of success and stability for the Roman Empire.
Hooray. Strong and stable.
Oh my God, ew, yes. And we use Hadrian in our LGBTQ+ session to trouble these LGBT labels a bit, to have a think about homosexuality, seeing as there's apparently no word for homosexual in Latin.
No.
But Hadrian openly has sex with lots and lots of men.
Yeah, and he's got a bust next to him of his lover Antonus. Antonus? Yeah.
Antonus.
Antonius? No, Antonus.
Antonus.
Yeah.
Is how it looks. And he was, yeah, he was, appears to be Hadrian's kind of special guy.
Yeah.
So the guy that, I mean, what does that mean? Does that mean he was sexually attracted to lots of people? He was also then sexually attracted and romantically attracted? Was he in love with Antonus? These are all things that we're kind of make, you know, we're trying to
we're
work
assuming.
Out.
And we often use labels and understandings of like our own relationships in modern day and like project them onto people in the past.
Absolutely.
Like Hadrian was gay. And it's like, well, gay didn't exist then. Hadrian had no understanding of what gay is. So how is that possible?
Absolutely. And we only know that Antonus was like dead special because he's in a bus.
Yeah,
in the British Museum next to Hadrian. Yeah. And he got a bus where he died tragically on the Nile. And Hadrian was so gutted that he made loads and loads of, well, he got other people to make lots of statues of him and also renamed a town, Antinopolis?
Antinopolis, yeah.
After Antonus to kind of really, hit that home. But also, Hadrian was married. He married.
Ah, so there was an empress.
Yes, she was 14 and he was 24.
Okay. How old was Antonus though? Because the way that their busts are depicted, Hadrian has a beard, which like symbolizes that he's the older guy, and Antonus has no beard.
Mm-hmm.
Which, from what I've seen, I know that the Romans and Greeks are different, but on Greek pots as well, it's like the same thing as like the no facial hair indicates that they're like prepubescent and young.
Yes.
And the facial hair means that they're like an adult.
Yeah, absolutely. So it says here that he was in his mid-teens.
Mid-teens.
Which was the normal Roman marrying age.
Oh, okay.
So it's trying to kind of normalise that for us now. Just like, ew.
So we're not like shocked.
Yeah, exactly. And he's kind of hanging out here like Dionysus.
He's got a wreath in his hair. Yeah.
So he's like being the like party god from the Greeks, I think that is. So was Hadrian bi? Maybe he was bi then, if he had a wife, but he also had Antonus.
Yeah. But that also would have been like expected of him to have a wife.
Exactly.
So was he in love with her? Was he not? Who knows?
Exactly.
Did he make any like busts of his wife? When like did she die before him or? Like, I don't know.
Interesting. As we look around, we can see some female busts. But we do know, that men and women, the gender roles were very rigid. There wasn't equality. Not like we have it now either. But, that's something to think about as well.
Mm-hmm.
But also, this also troubles people's idea of what it means to be a leader, what it means to be the most powerful person. The leader of the Roman Empire to be, as people would see now, openly gay.
Yeah.
Of course we're not
openly gay
that term.
And also like openly grieving for a same-sex lover.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, would we see that in America today? No. Mm. Have we ever had an openly gay prime minister in this country? No.
No.
So, was Roman society more progressive?
Who knows?
Than our society?
Who knows?
Who knows?
Exciting points to discuss.
Yeah.
I need to stop saying exciting. I will stop saying that now.
It is exciting, though.
I know.
And the Antonus bust has this little orange sticker on it that says desire, love and identity, because there's like an LGBTQ+ trail that you can do throughout the British Museum and it like will tell you like all the different objects relating to LGBT history.
Yes, the British Museum has been doing loads of work on this, actually. Even though this aspect of our lives and all our human history has been hidden for a long time, the British Museum is really trying.
I think also, this is the first time I've come here and seen the orange stickers, which I like, because what that's to me saying is, it's like, we're not hiding this. It's not like this secret page on the website that you have to find and you have to seek it out and then do the trail yourself. It's like, if you were just a regular visitor wandering around, you would still see that and be like, oh, LGBT.
Definitely. And it's nice that they haven't all been shoved in a gay room together or in a
queer room. Is there a gay room?
No, there isn't.
Oh, okay, good.
But it's nice as well that all these artifacts and objects get to stay within their culture and their time period so that we can see that actually gender diversity and sexuality diversity is present across the whole of our history.
Yeah.
Across the whole of our
From planet. Now until forever.
We're just a couple of steps down from Hadrian and Antonis looking at the Warren Cup, which is a silver kind of goblet thing which you'd get out for parties. It's not really like an everyday cup.
No, it's a pretty majestic cup. Especially because there are depictions of people having sex on the cup. Men specifically having sex in the cup. And then someone sneaking out behind a door and playing peekaboo and watching them.
Yes.
Yeah, there is a lot here. What do you like talk about in the sessions with this cup?
Yeah, so we use this cup to speak specifically about sex, because I think you really can with this.
Yeah. And you can literally see genitals inside
sex is happening.
Other people.
Yeah, penetration is occurring. Obviously, sex doesn't always involve penetration.
No. Is the other sex scene also penetration? Yeah, it is. And they're in a different position. It's like very versatile. Are they the same people? I don't know.
No, they're not the same people. Mm. So, we were talking before about there being an older lover and a younger lover, a dominant and a passive.
One of them has a beard and one of them does not.
Does not, exactly. And on the other side, one is wearing a wreath, I think, and the other one is not.
Yes.
So there is this kind of symbolic depiction of this power dynamic relationship, which was very important for the Romans.
Mm-hmm.
So to be able to be a man still in Rome, you had to be the active lover.
Yep.
So you had to be the older lover. Older men would have sex with younger men, and it would be part of the younger man's like development into a man.
Like a rite of passage.
Exactly, and that was okay. And it was also okay if you were an older man having sex with a younger man, who we think of as a young person, as a boy now.
But so what would have been not okay? Like two younger men having sex?
Well, I think two older men having sex. I think that would be the ultimate form of not okayness.
Oh, I
Probably
see.
Probably young as well, yeah?
Because it was about power, it wasn't necessarily about sex. I don't know.
Well, yeah, I mean, yes, exactly, as well. Like, what, yeah, what was this about? Was it about sexual attraction? Was it about
And also in terms of what this cup is for, so like, first of all, it's for drinking out of, maybe. Who knows, maybe it was just an ornament. But we were talking before about like how to define porn and it being like the intent of it is for arousal. Is the intent of this cup for arousal?
Great question. This is what we talk about.
Okay.
Yeah? This is pornographic.
Yeah.
Often people say it's not pornographic because they're not moving. Which is...
I mean, people read erotica. People look at images. So is that saying that all the, you know, the top shelf magazines, is that not porn because they're not moving?
So within the kind of realm of the understanding of what pornography is, for the people, the young people who come and do the workshops, if it's not on the internet and they're not moving, it's not porn.
Because porn is like this narrow thing of like, it's videos of people having sex.
Yeah. So we use this to talk about, okay, if we know that we, as a society, like we use pornography to learn about sex, because, I mean, it's there.
It's there.
And people are having sex in it. What a great way to learn about sex. By watching other people have sex, right? Guys, yeah?
Yeah. So I'm following.
So then we talk about here, I give out lots of questions and we see what we can learn about sex from looking at this.
If we just saw this and this was our only education around sex, what would we think sex is?
Exactly, like pornography is right now for lots of people because we don't have it at school
so
much.
I would think that sex isn't for me because the only people I see in this are men. I would also think that sex is penetration.
And I would also think that it's okay for someone else to stick their head around the corner and watch.
Exactly, exactly. And we know that this might represent some people's idea of sex, but it doesn't represent lots and lots of people's idea of sex. And that's the kind of point we're trying to raise, or the idea. Like, how long does sex last? Can we tell that? Nope.
Also, I've just noticed that none of them are looking into each other's eyes. So it's penetration, but there's no eye contact.
I mean, these people are like opposite, like definitely looking away from
each other. They are looking away from each other, and then these other two are looking in the same direction, but not at each other.
Mm.
Yeah.
So that's interesting as well. Thinking about how the people are relating to each other, how close they are, obviously physically, but intellectually or mentally or romantically.
But also, you know, you were saying about the power dynamics and like being the active or the passive or like the inserter or the insertee, whatever language you want to use. With these two here, the one who is receiving the penetration is like on top. They're both facing the same way and he's holding a rope. So the idea of him holding that rope actually gives him a lot more power and a lot more like of an active role, and he's in a lot more control in terms of like how deep the penetration is and like the pace of it and everything. So that's quite interesting actually, because when I look at that, I'm like, oh, you'd think that the person doing the penetration is in control, but because he's holding onto a rope, it's like, oh, actually he has more control over what he's doing with his body.
So this is really not exciting. I was going to use the word exciting. This is real good for questioning this idea of penetration always being the active, as opposed to seclusion, which is a word that I try and kind of introduce to people.
I've heard the word covering being used in terms of being like the active role of the person who has the hole. They're covering. There's a lot of that. I think there's a lot of people trying to like make that language more accessible and people more aware of it, because I think we've done a good job of like breaking down gender stereotypes in terms of like the man is the active one in sex and the woman is the passive one in sex, and then we kind of broke that down and then we were like, no, the penetrator is the active one,
whatever
gender they are, and the penetratee is the passive one, and now we're like breaking that down even further and like, no, you can be active and being the one that's being penetrated at the same time, which is where I think that language is coming from.
And that, I think that shows how important talking about sex is. Because actually, like, language and ways we identify and groups and communities we want to belong to sometimes and then kind of want to question, all of this stuff is so important, so important.
Yeah.
So you can get a lot of knowledge and a lot of questioning and a lot of from talking about sex.
Definitely.
I don't know if it's ever mentioned in relation to this, but the two guys, and I've never thought about it with a couple before, the two guys looking in the same direction, I read a whole essay at uni about using mirrors in sex during the Roman era. There are bedrooms that have mirrors on ceilings,
So maybe they were both watching themselves in a mirror.
Because lots of people have these amazing frescoes, they only survive in places that burnt down, but of couples, like quite intimately involved, and so it's like a lot of people have looked at this like, well, the woman's clearly being objectified in this and that, but if you think about mirrors and both the couples actually looking at themselves, then you can start thinking about those frescoes as actually, are you seeing yourself in this rather than is it a pornographic thing that is there to stimulate the man so that you two can get down to business? But yeah, there's mirrors. Like, I don't know if it's
we need some of this. We need this in the world. It is in the world. It's still recording. Yes.
So that lovely voice you heard at the end talking about Roman sex mirrors was Nick, who was following me and Chloe around with audio equipment and making sure that our mics were recording the whole time. Nick is a creative producer for the British Museum and runs their YouTube channel, amongst other things. So thank you so much, Nick, for your support on the day. Thank you, Chloe, for all of your words of wisdom. Thank you, Melanie, for being one of the reasons why this program exists in the first place. I will leave links in the description where you can find out more about the sex education workshops, and I'll also leave some links to Chloe's work if you are interested in other stuff that she does as an artist and an educator. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Don't forget to follow us on social media at Banging Book Club and go and vote in the poll for what we're going to be reading in December. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.